friends and listeners. Thank you for tuning in today. My name is Henrik, and you are listening to Red Ice Radio. If you are new to the program, we encourage you to check out redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. We address many of the important topics that are, to a large extent, censored from mainstream discourse, but that ends up affecting us the most. These are issues related to the erosion of our culture and who we are, and how the rigid politically correct environment prevents us from not only knowing the truth, but to have an honest, open, and truthful debate about the rapid destruction of our nations, our society, and our traditions. It is, to a large extent, a conspiracy by omission. The controversial and what is deemed to be offensive has been largely removed from the debate. But the reality is that we can't just look the other way and pretend that these things will go away. But what is the response today if you cross the line? You're fired. That's it. You're out. Unfriend. This is not tolerance. It's running from the issues like a child without actually examining some of the claims. We can't hide from issues that hurt or are painful. This is not the way to go about it, because ultimately this will make things even worse. When you can see that the country you once knew is changing right in front of your eyes, and you can observe what is happening, but the media and the cultural elite denies that these things are happening, and that it's somehow just in your head, well, then that has to be one of the most Orwellian manifestations of that particular warning that we can imagine, that your concerns are not real. But if they were, well, then you're the bigot and the hater for pointing it out. Jacques Senn is our guest today. He was a UKIP prospective member of Parliament for Northern England before being unceremoniously and quite publicly suspended by his party 1 week prior to the general election for attempting to broach the subject of indigenous displacement in Britain and raising the issue of the genocide waged against the Boer people in South Africa. Around that same time, a Twitter storm also ensued after he tweeted a comment about where Labour MP Luciana Berger's loyalties lie. We have a one-segment extended program for you today. We're going to go through his story, what happened, and his views on UKIP from the inside. Jack has a lot of things to share with us, specifically on bringing unwanted issues to our attention, on all the things we're not supposed to talk about or notice. Welcome, Jack. Thank you for coming on the program with us. It's good to have you here today.
Thanks, Henrik. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak on your fine program.
Well, thank you. Now, before we speak more about your story, what happened to you, how the media dealt with what happened to you, and try to, I guess, clear up about some of these things, tell us what attracted you to UKIP, Jack.
It's quite an interesting story, actually. It has some connection to you in a way. I was in Sweden. I was visiting friends over there, and I was in northern Sweden, a place called Örnsköldsvik. And I was planning on going back to Britain with my family. We were in a really rural area, and Britain had been changing quite a bit over the last decade. And I wasn't happy with the way things were changing. So I wanted to get involved with politics, and I discovered Nigel Farage on YouTube. This is 3 or 4 years ago. And I said to myself, when I get back to Britain, I want to get involved with this United Kingdom Independence Party. They want to leave the European Union. I recognized the European Union was obviously a big problem for Western Europe especially. And I basically wanted to get back into Europe and get back into Britain and get involved with politics. And my mum had a really close friend who was a parliamentary candidate for UKIP. So when I got back, I gave her a ring. He and I met, and he introduced me to the party. They recognized something interesting in me, and they wanted me to run for parliament pretty quickly. And that was when the ball started rolling. And within a year, I was fast-tracked into a parliamentary election in my grandparents' hometown in northern England. That was it, pretty much. Just my desire to get Britain out of the European Union, based on my experiences in Sweden and in Italy, where I recognized immigration was a major problem. In Italy, more Eastern European immigration was an issue as well, where Romanians and Albanians had taken over entire villages. So it was I really wanted to see a moratorium on immigration in Great Britain, except for skilled workers. And although, you know, the United Kingdom Independence Party weren't talking about a full-fledged moratorium, it did seem as though they were the most anti-mass immigration party on the market. So I selected them, and then they selected me back.
All right. Well, you know, we interviewed actually Nigel Farage back in 2009, and I always thought that one of his strongest points was his critique of the European Union and the speeches he did at the Parliament and things like that, that really kind of, I think, attracted a lot of people to it as well. But just for those who might not know, how are things, politically speaking, in Britain at the moment? Is UKIP, beyond being critical of the EU, kind of the only party that really touch the immigration question, or how's the climate like in Britain?
Well, in Great Britain, I would say the major parties are all pro-immigration. Even though the Conservatives are going to offer up a referendum on Britain's membership in the European Union, they're going to spend British taxpayer money to promote European Union during the run-up to the referendum. So although they're going to offer the referendum, they're going to be pushing people to vote no. So really, UKIP is the only party in Great Britain that, you know, that has any parliamentary seats that is against the European Union. Whereas the Green with one or two seats, the Lib Dems with eight seats, and the Labour and the Conservative Party with several hundred seats each, they're all pro-European Union. And only the Conservatives of the major parties offered a referendum, and that's because obviously there was a lot of pressure from backbenchers on the right wing of the Conservative Party who were, you know, is sympathetic with the United Kingdom Independence Party, UKIP. But certainly UKIP is the only party in Great Britain that you would consider a major party that is quite anti-European Union.
Yeah. Now, isn't there going to be a referendum? I think, wasn't that one of the things that Cameron actually promised? Do you think that's going to go through on the EU membership, I mean?
There will be a referendum, I'm quite sure. Whether we actually vote ourselves out of the European Union, I don't think so. I mean, like I said earlier, David Cameron is going to be spending a lot of money, a lot of taxpayer money, promoting the European Union during the run-up to the referendum, convincing people who are not sure which way to vote to stay in. So I think originally it would have been about 45 to vote out versus 55 to stay in. With that added money, I think it's going to be 40-60. 40 will vote to come out, 60 will vote to stay in. So I think that even if there's a referendum, people will vote to stay in, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's a damn shame. You know, I think if Britain would be able to get out, I think other countries would start kind of looking at it as well. But, you know, Ireland had that opportunity before they had a little special thing going on there after the Lisbon Treaty, and they could, shake things up. But they didn't. They ended up voting for it for some reason. I don't know what that's predicated on, if people are kind of, I don't know, scared into submission, or if it's a lot of propaganda around it, because surely people on the street have to see that this has not been beneficial to Britain at all, right?
No, the problem is, I think, people really believe that if Britain leaves the European Union, the economy will collapse. I mean, we're told constantly on television and by all the experts that if Britain leaves the European Union, there'll be no one to trade with. I mean, it's a bunch of nonsense, but unfortunately people are scared into believing that's the case.
Yeah.
People are scared that the economy will fall flat, we'll have no one to trade with. And also, I think they're scared, this might sound kind of strange, that it'll be harder to travel to Europe on holiday. British people do travel to Spain, Portugal, Italy quite a bit on holiday, and they probably fear that they might not be able to. And what happens if they work abroad, or will they have to pay extra taxes on their second homes? I mean, there are several million British people that actually live in Spain, who own properties in Spain. So I think they're fearful as well, and they have a vote. And then there's also the Eastern Europeans living in Great Britain who have a vote as well. And there's quite a few of them, obviously. I think there's something in the vicinity of a million of them. So we're talking about a huge chunk of people that will come out and vote against leaving the European Union, as they voted in the Scottish referendum to leave Scotland. I mean, the vast majority of the people who voted to leave Scotland in Scotland were not Scottish. They were immigrants, and they were students, and people who didn't even live in Scotland who had voting rights, who were living in England. So I think it was something like 20% of people who voted to leave the United Kingdom in Scotland were actually not Scottish.
Yeah,
they were actually immigrants. So we have the same problem in Britain, where a lot of our immigrants will vote to obviously stay in the European Union.
Yeah, yeah, beneficial to them, no doubt.
Now, it is certainly, yeah.
Now we'll talk more about obviously UKIP here in a little bit, and what your view of them has changed the party. I mean, your journey, if you will. But before we do that, is there anything you want to say about the latest election because I'm trying to understand the election process. UKIP did get quite a bit of votes, but they only ended up with one seat, and I still, no one has sufficiently explained this to me. Why did that happen?
Well, it's unlike the European Parliament, where it's a proportional representation. In the parliamentary elections, it's first past the post. So basically, in your constituency, I was West Lancashire, so we had 75 odd thousand people whoever votes gets one vote, and the people who get the most vote win. So although UKIP did get between 5 and 25% in all the elections, they only finished first in one of the elections. So we had a lot of second places, a lot of third places, many, many fourth places, but only one first place. So in order to win your seat, you have to finish in first. Whereas it's very different in the European election, where if you get a percentage of the vote, you will get a percentage, therefore, of the seats. It doesn't work that way in Parliament, unfortunately.
Huh, interesting. Yes, it's a different system for sure. I mean, I know that Farage resigned afterwards, and he said basically that, you know, he talked about some kind of election reform has to be done in England for something to be done about this. Would you agree with that?
I can see the argument for it, certainly. But in all fairness, I mean, I was in West Lancashire. I finished with 6,000 some odd votes. And if they were to give me a seat in Parliament, I lost my seat in West Lancashire. So where would they stick me? Would they parachute me into another jurisdiction and have me represent there? I mean, I think people have the right to, choose who they want to represent them locally. So unless you change the system where it's no longer local representation and it's a national thing, how can you change it? I mean, if you vote, let's just say in your region of Sweden, you have a lot of people who are very in favor of, let's say, the Green Party, for example. And so Green will win. But if Green wouldn't have enough votes nationwide, then it wouldn't get any seats. It's the same sort of thing. I think we have to be very cautious not to corrupt the democratic process. I think it is quite fair that if you live in a region and that region chooses one party, that party should represent that region. What we need to do is find a way to get people to understand that the parties they're choosing are wrong. I don't think the system is wrong. I think the system is rigged, unfortunately, where people believe the only parties that are worth voting for are the same parties that have won for generations. So we need to get people realizing that these parties are going to spell the demise of Great Britain. Once people realize that these parties will destroy the country, then they will start choosing secondary parties.
Yeah, I wonder how bad it has to get before people do that, make that move, you know.
Agree. It's a big one. I mean, I was just in London, as we discussed earlier. I traveled up north, and London, it's another country.
Minority British people in your capital city now, right?
I would say so. I mean, to be honest with you, in the region my hotel was located, which is just outside the airport, I was meeting people in that around the airport. I don't think I spoke with very many native English speakers. So I'm not even speaking about English people, not even Indians from England who spoke English as their first language. Everyone in this place was an immigrant. So they were from India, Pakistan, Somalia, all parts of sub-Saharan Africa, Eastern Europe. But not one person I encountered on my travels in that particular place spoke English as a first language.
Wow.
No, that's a shame. That's obviously a bloody shame. Excuse my language.
No worries. I understand why you're choosing those words, and we certainly could be harder with our words considering what actually is happening here. But did you ever see that clip? I think it was John Cleese.
I'm not sure what's going on in Britain. Let me say this. I don't know what's going on in London, because London is no longer an English city, and that's how they got the Olympics. I mean, they said we're the most cosmopolitan city on Earth, but it doesn't feel English. I had a Californian friend come over 2 months ago, walked down the King's Road and said to me, well, where are all the English people? And I mean, I love having different cultures around, but when the parent culture kind of dissipates, you're left thinking, well, what's going on?
I mean, he said he appreciated multiculturalism and he appreciated different cultures, as do I. But he said that, you know, something is wrong when the host country is like starting to lose grip on its own capital, when there's like when people come from other parts in the world to experience British culture and see and meet British people. And they're like asking, but where is all the British people? There's no one around here, you know?
Yeah, I actually saw that clip and I agree with what you're saying and what John said, Mr. Cleese said. It's, you know, the culture of the country needs to stay intact. How much can you dilute the country? I mean, there's an argument that you add some people from other countries, you add some spice to the mix. But when does that become dominate the flavor of the country? And I think we've reached that tipping point. We're at a point now where you don't taste Britain anymore. You taste another country inside of Britain. And that's a sad, I mean, not where I live. Where I live and where I fought for Parliament, it's a predominantly English country, English-speaking and English cultural region. However, like you're saying, in all the major cities in London, the culture has been diluted to such an extent it no longer feels like England, and that's a shame. I mean, I would hope that the immigrants who've come would also recognize they came to Britain for a reason. Britain yeah. offered something that they could not get in their own countries. Why would they want to turn our country into their country? Why not just stay in their own country? It does not make sense. I mean, I can't understand why even immigrants would want to do such a thing.
Yeah. I agree. It's very bizarre. Let's see if we can get, I guess, to the root and talk a little bit more about that later. But let's just kind of get into the UKIP story, your journey now, obviously, and talk about it. You view this as one of the only options to try to do something about immigration and the European Union. Basically, well, centralized politics that goes above people's heads in the same way that people don't get an opportunity to, for example, vote on mass immigration, etc. But yeah, tell us what happened to you along the way and I guess your journey within the party, Jack.
Sure. Well, I joined the party. Right away, I met the local chairman, and he wanted me to run locally where I am now in Southport. I decided that I did not want to do that because there was already a few people interested in running for parliament. So what I did was I moved to my grandparents' area, which is just about 20 minutes from Southport. And I met with the chairman, and he said right away that they'd like to have me stand for parliament. The region had not changed to such an extent where it had gone beyond the point of no return, but certainly things were changing. There were a lot of immigrants, a lot of Eastern European migrants. There were some asylum seekers. Unfortunately, the left had wrecked the council. Students had taken over the town to the extent where all the shops had closed down. So there were more bigger things than just immigration. There was lots of things that got me interested in UKIP. So I ran, and I saw UKIP quite naively as the anti-immigration party quite early on. But I recognized when I was running that was not entirely the case. I guess my first understanding that we were not the anti-immigration parties, when we discussed at one of our conventions that I actually introduced the subject there should be a moratorium on immigration. However, obviously that was not going to happen in Great Britain. So, although we were amongst friends, I could say there should be a moratorium on immigration. But let's have a cap. And they said, absolutely, we should not have a cap. It's bad for business. I said, well, a cap would mean that we bring the right people in to fill the positions, but once we fill the positions, we could stop it. And they said, no, cap is bad for business. So that kind of put me off. I then wanted to do a leaflet. And in my leaflet, I typed it up myself. I sent it to the press officer. It said, only accept immigrants who are culturally and ethnically compatible. And I put in culturally and ethnically. Before I posted it to her, I looked at it long and hard, and I thought to myself, UKIP's a great party, but they're not going to go for the ethnically bit because they have to toe the line. So I'll remove ethnically and just write culturally compatible. That's obviously not a problem because we discuss culture constantly at all the conventions. It was sent back to me and they said, absolutely not. You cannot put culturally compatible. I said, why can't you put culturally compatible? They said, well, because we're a multicultural country. I said, well, isn't that what we're fighting? And they said, well, you can't put it. So that, I was right away, I was a bit perturbed. And this was about 3 months before the election. So, and then I would suppose the what kind of put me off UKIP for good was when I did an interview with the European Knights Project website, which is a website that discusses South Africa. And I have a background in South Africa. I have a grandparent from Cape Town. And they asked me about Nelson Mandela. And I gave my honest opinion that I thought he was a terrorist. And I gave the reasons why I thought he was. And I discussed Joe Slovo and some of the people that were responsible for the rise of the African National Congress. And the majority of these people were Ashkenazi Jews from Eastern Europe who fled Germany and Eastern European nations and moved to South Africa, as they did Great Britain. I gave this interview. It was completely, it was a decent interview. I said nothing I shouldn't have. It was, completely, by the by. And I received a frantic phone call from the head of candidates who I'd never spoken to before named David Sauter. I mentioned his name because he's been in the press a lot recently, and I can go into that later on. Mm-hmm. But he told me, how dare you insult the great Nelson Mandela? And I said to him, I said, the great Nelson Mandela, I said, do you recognize that he was a terrorist? He said, he was not a terrorist. He's a hero in this country. If I'd known that you had these feelings, I would never have let you pass the assessment phase. I said, what feelings? He said, that Nelson Mandela's a terrorist. And I said, well, I said, mate, he was a terrorist. I mean, he was convicted of murdering people. And he, even Amnesty International refused to pardon him. They refused to represent him in court. And he would not budge. And I spoke to other people in UKIP about Mandela, and they all agreed he was a wonderful man. And these are people in administrative positions. They were not in, you know, lower-level positions. They were not volunteers. They were not grassroots supporters. They were not parliamentary candidates. These are people who were paid by UKIP to run the party. When I spoke with the people on the ground, they agreed with me that he was a terrorist. But the people who ran the show did not. At the end of the conversation with David Sauter, he told me, do not give any interviews on this subject. I said, well, what happens if, you know, the papers ring me and they're going to write an article? Because he rang me because the Daily Mail was going to run a story. And I said, I'm going to speak to them. I'm not going to let them, you know, print lies. So when the Daily Mail rang me, I responded to the interviewer. I responded fairly. I was quite respectable. I did not make UKIP look bad in any way, but I was lambasted by UKIP for doing so. And that was kind of the beginning of my end within the party. And it was also the point where I realized that UKIP and I were not compatible. So it was kind of the point where we both recognized that, you know, Jack Sen is not right for UKIP and UKIP is not right for Jack Sen. However, this is only a month before the election, so it's kind of difficult to do anything about it at this point.
So they felt that, oh my God, this is way too much to damage before the elections and whatnot. So, but interestingly, it was really then a question which isn't pertaining directly to Britain that caused all this. So you were talking about South Africa, and all, you know, you have, as you said, a grandparent from there. You know some stuff about this, but that was enough to basically get you out.
Yeah, it was. I mean, the idea that there was a genocide of non-black people in South Africa was something that I should not be speaking about. Right. And I said, look, this is, you know, I have a background in history. I'm allowed to discuss these things on an academic level. I mean, just because, I mean, there are people who are doctors who are running for UKIP, for Parliament. They don't stop speaking about medicine because they're running for Parliament. I studied history at university. I've written books. I have the right to discuss these topics on an interview, which is pertaining to history. But they told me that this was off limits for me. And I did accept that at that point, and I did not talk about it anymore, but I think the damage had been done. Ultimately, when I was suspended, they did actually mention my interview with this European Knights Project website and my opinion about Nelson Mandela and, quote, white genocide. They actually used that as one of the reasons why they suspended me. They backtracked from that later on, saying it was just my, quote, anti-Semitism. But certainly I do believe that that was part of the issue. There's a lot of South African people in Britain, you know, there's a lot of discussion on the topic, but it's something you can't speak about. And I think that my decision to broach the subject publicly was something they weren't too happy with.
Yeah. Well, it's hilarious how you have to, you know, toe the line and how narrow the accepted opinions are and where you can't question and have a different view. Be that of people or events or what have you, but that's, I mean, do you think that the people a little bit higher up in UKIP, they just don't get into that because they just know that, I mean, it's such a harsh, politically correct environment that they just know from a political, strategical perspective, like, just stay away from it, even though we might be the truth or not. What do you think?
I agree that's definitely part of it, but I also believe the way David Sauter and John Stanier, these are important players in UKIP, the way they talked about Mandela, they genuinely felt he was a great man. So I think it was also ideological. I do believe that these people, I think they're pro-multiculturalism. I don't believe they're really for a unicultural environment. I think they're, I mean, give you a couple of examples. I mean, Andrew Bronze is a former member of European Parliament for the British National Party. I had lunch with him a few weeks back in my hometown. He told me that when Nigel Farage was asked, this is when Nigel Farage was a member of parliament at the same time as Andrew Bronze, so this would have been about 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. He was asked what his greatest achievement was in UKIP. And he stated, no, not that we have 13 members of European Parliament, not that we're now Britain's third party, not that we have a chance to win a parliamentary seat at the general election. He stated, for the record, that it was he put the final nail in the coffin of the BNP. So for the head of the UK Independence Party to say that his biggest achievement was destroying the British National Party, where at least 20% of the votes come from the BNP wing of UKIP. I mean, a lot of UKIP supporters are former BNP supporters. it says a great deal about what Farage's endgame is. So is Farage really trying to destroy British nationalism, or is Farage using this sentiment to promote UK Independence Party? I personally don't know. A lot of people in the BNP believe that Farage is, you know, establishment safety valve. UKIP is controlled opposition, that it's designed to destroy nationalism. I'm not sure if that's the case, or Farage is so crafty he recognizes that the media will embrace him if he comes out against the actual nationalistic parties. So it's a tough one. I'm not sure, chicken or the egg, which came first. I'm not sure.
Right. So, okay, well, that's a good point, because I was wondering, like, anyway, why would he even say this openly then? But that makes sense. He kind of want to signal to those who are in the know in some way that, like, yep, I'm with you. I mean, it could be that they're just, they had a rival relationship for a while there, I believe, right? It was like, it's either UKIP or BNP, right?
Yeah, when I met with Andrew Bronze, he's a really wonderful man. I have not met one person in UKIP even remotely, even close to his status, the way he handles himself. He was just honest, and he said to me, look, UKIP, when they were in Parliament, when they were in the European Parliament, they treated us worse than the other parties, which is quite strange. You think that UKIP and the British National Party would have some kind of overlap, ideological overlap. I mean, one would believe that they're both against the European Union, the only two parties that were represented in Europe to be against the EU. They were both against mass immigration, but yet they were openly hostile towards the BNP, more so than even the Labour Party. I mean, he told me that he had better relations with Labour MEPs than he did with people like Paul Nuttall and Nigel Farage, who are just complete. I mean, Paul Nuttall's a complete left-wing ideologue. I see him more of a Labour Party rep than anything else. I mean, he's from an area of Liverpool which is staunchly Labour. The majority of his policies are quite left-wing. And, you know, he's an MEP for UKIP, but he's also, quote, anti-racist at the same time. So I don't know, to be honest with you. It's a really tough call. Did UKIP become the anti-racist, anti-immigration party, or were they designed to kind of subvert nationalism? It's an interesting one. Based on what I've learned about how UKIP handled themselves in Brussels when they were, you know, sitting on the same benches as MEPs from the BNP, it seems like they were more hostile than even the Tories and the Labour Party were. So that tells me there's something ideological there as well.
Interesting. Okay, well, let's kind of go into that a little bit later too here in more detail. But tell us just what happened next then. How were you kicked out finally then from the party?
Well, I was doing quite well. I got a phone call from the Northwest region saying I was polling at 18%, which is about 5% higher than the national average. They didn't even give me £150 to help me with my campaign. Things were going quite well. I then received quite a few death threats in the post from far-left organizations. They recognized that some of my politics were farther to the right than the average UKIP candidate. So I received quite a bizarre series of letters that were directed at me, my chairperson, all the newspapers, all the organizers, saying that if I had spoken at certain events, that they would kill me and kill my family. UKIP completely ignored this. They had no time for me whatsoever. It was quite strange. Instead of coming to my defense or offering me some sort of protection or advice, they told me, don't speak to the media. We're not interested in what happened. Just don't speak to the media. So it was quite strange. So I progressed. I went farther. I was doing really well. I was about 18%. And I figured I would finish probably a close second behind the Conservative. Within about 2 weeks before the election, I started becoming slightly more aggressive in my campaigning. I started becoming a bit hostile to the Labour Party and the Conservative Party because I wanted to obviously bring votes my direction. So I started, you know, writing some articles in the local newspaper. I started writing letters to the editor, some articles for some websites, and I decided I wanted to be aggressive, so I started sending out some tweets. One of my tweets was in response to a lady named Luciana Berger. Mm-hmm. Luciana Berger is quite well known in Northern England for being a hardcore Zionist, as well as a She's hostile to freedom of speech. She's had people arrested for anti-Semitism on numerous occasions. She's had run-ins with the website called The Daily Stormer. She's quite an interesting piece of work. She sat on the NEC for the British Student Union for many years, and she resigned because her fellow leftist NEC board members were anti-Semitic. So this woman finds anti-Semitism around every single corner she walks. So she wrote a tweet that stated, for the record, that if I'm reelected, I will give more child benefit to Liverpool. And this is a woman who once sat as the president of the Labour Friends of Israel and is one of the most pro-EU Labour parliamentarians. So I tweeted back, if you had it your way, you would prefer to send the money to Poland and Israel. I thought nothing of it. This is someone who represents the European Union and also used to be a president of the Labour Friends of Israel. So it makes sense that she's got some foreign loyalties.
She's open, quite open about that. Is that correct?
Oh, certainly. I mean, she was parachuted into Liverpool by, you know, several Jewish Zionist Labour MPs and Lords directly into Liverpool from West London, where she hails from. So, you know, she's not got a major... Even the local Labour Party are quite hostile towards her. And she is seen as... she's seen as a traitor by many people. Articles have been written about her, numerous publications online, about how she is, you know, Zionist first, British citizen second. So my statement was not that, you know, was not that extreme in any way, shape, or form. I mean, it was quite fair to point out the obvious. So I received quite a odd cryptic email the following day or the day afterwards that said, it was from someone in higher up in UKIP, someone in the legal department said to me, Jack, please correct me if I'm wrong, but we've been told you're an anti-Semite. And this came to my inbox after I'd just been to a local high school speaking to students about my politics, and it went quite well. So I thought nothing of it. I figured I'd respond after dinner. So I didn't respond. I went back to making my dinner. Then I got a phone call, and it was from the BBC. And they said, how do you feel about being suspended, Mr. Sen? I said, suspended? I said, suspended from what?
Yeah, exactly.
They said, suspended from UKIP. And I said, I've been suspended? I said, I had no idea. And I put the phone down, and I was, you know, I was quite shaken up. I wasn't sure what to think. I thought they might have been having me on. I never asked who the person was.
Mm-hmm.
I never asked for a phone number. It came from London, I saw, but I never asked any of the details for the person, the credentials or anything like that. I then decided to go onto my UKIP email address, and I saw in the subject of an email that had been sent to me within the last half hour of this phone call that you've been formally suspended by the UK Independence Party. And so I was quite stunned because I had no concept of I had no idea why or what I had done. So I read the email, and they told me to do nothing, sit tight. They would have a hearing for me within 24 to 48 hours, and that they would, you know, they would decide at that point then what I could and what I could not do. So here I am, 1 week before the election, thinking I'm suspended. I spent £5,000 on my campaign. I'm running at 18%. I just traveled to different high schools to speak about my campaign. You know, I'm going to be leafleting all day on Saturday. I have 20 volunteers across the county helping me, and I'm suspended with no one to talk to because it's the weekend. So I waited, and nothing came in. I then emailed them at least half a dozen times, Legal, David Souter, all these different people, not a response, nothing. I then phoned my local chairperson. He told me that I'd been suspended, and he was told that they could not campaign on my behalf anymore, and that he thought I'd be off the ballot. And, you know, I was obviously heartbroken, you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here I've been doing this for over a year, campaigning for almost 6 months, and spent a fortune of my own money, and I'm now off the ballot. So I was quite shocked. I then happened to read, I Googled my name, I saw that there was an ITV interview with Nigel Farage where he was embarrassed about, you know, such an important man like Jack Sen, who was just a small parliamentary candidate for rural northern England.
Mm-hmm.
He held a press conference to say how embarrassed he was about me. I was quite shocked. I said, what have I done? I know I'm not ideologically identical to UKIP, but I certainly haven't done anything wrong. My mum rang me saying that she had been told by someone, one of her mates, that they'd seen it on the BBC. I was like, oh my goodness, I'm destroyed. I mean, it's on the BBC. Here I am in a rural province in northern England, and I'm, you know, front page news in all the newspapers, and it was quite shocking. It was difficult.
Do you think that the rest of the media as well, they kind of take this as an opportunity to kind of through through you criticize UKIP, basically, right? That's usually how it works. So it's like, okay, let's, because, I mean, the media is, as far as I've understood it, largely not really positive towards UKIP's political suggestions, right?
See, Henrik, that's what I thought as well, precisely that this was an opportunity to attack UKIP, and UKIP, in order to save face, had to do away with me. However, since then, I've learned it's a lot more devious than that. I really believe that's quite, yeah, unfortunately, I was quite naive, and on the surface, I would say that's the case. There are certain members of the mainstream media, certain journalists, certain sites like The Guardian, that are certainly anti-UKIP. But there are other papers that are using UKIP like a controlled opposition party. I mean, you look at the Daily Express. Richard Desmond is Jewish. He's a Zionist. He donated several million quid to Tony Blair when Tony Blair was, you know, the head of the Labour Party. He's now the number one the backer of UKIP. How do you go from a Labour Party led by Tony Blair, Zionist warmongering machine, to pro-European Union, to a anti-European Union, right-leaning, conservative, anti-war UKIP?
Yeah, that's interesting.
How does one make that trend? How does one make that jump within only a few years? So one has to ask the question that even if UKIP was organically the way I've stated, have they been turned? When did they turn? Have they been turned for longer than I've known about? I mean, I'm still not sure myself. I'd love to tell you that I believe UKIP is a controlled opposition run by Zionist entities. I don't know. I think that they've been infiltrated for sure. And I can give you some examples later on in the discussion on why I believe that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah,
based on the money they're receiving from the Daily Express, I believe that they are now completely under the thumb of the same people the other parties are under the thumb of.
Now, by the way, just because I guess it was primarily the Twitter kind of spout that set this about, can people see that conversation still on Twitter, or has it been taken down? Do you know?
I never took that down. No. If you Google my name and you Google like Guardian, Jack Sen Guardian or Jack Sen Channel 4, I mean, there's articles, you know, the UKIP Nazi or, you know, Jack Sen is a national socialist. I mean, it really got out of hand. I mean, it got so bad that I was receiving letters in the post with my leaflet. I was wearing an SS cap and a Hitler mustache painted on my face.
God, really?
I mean, it got quite extreme. I mean, I was called in all the local papers the UKIP Nazi. It was quite...
Right, right.
At first, I was taken aback, but, you know, I eventually ran with it, and I enjoyed it.
Sorry to hear about this. Well, but you did receive death threats as well. Did you follow through on that and report some of those, or what happened there?
I did, with the police, but unfortunately, since I got suspended, whenever I spoke with the police about it, they seemed more interested in my politics than actually the death threats. It seemed as though they were investigating me.
Right.
It's crazy, because Luciana Berger actually put in a request that I be arrested for hate speech based on that Twitter comment, if you can imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There was a call from some Zionist organization in Britain. It might have been the Jewish Chronicle. I can't remember who it was. But they actually requested that I be arrested. So.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Well, I'll just want to link to that and see so people can take a look at it for themselves and read that. Because, I mean, how is it, do you think, is any of this predicated on whether it actually is true or not, that if you could provide evidence for your claim, that should be enough to at least merit a discussion on the issue and raise concerns that, okay, is there people here who do have an interest in a foreign nation as opposed to Britain? You'd think that would be a valid point, but I guess not, right?
Well, I think if she was from Pakistan, it would be a valid point. I think we could quite easily raise... I mean, you can't criticize Muslims, but you can. With the Jews, you can't criticize them, and you can't criticize them. With Muslims, you can't say things like, you know, Muslims are dangerous, or they're violent, or they're likely to blow up a building. That you can't say. But you can certainly criticize a Muslim who's got links to, let's just say, a radical Islamic mosque. You could certainly bring that to the attention of the authorities. You could actually tweet about that. I mean, there were several UKIP members who'd made some quite anti-Islamic statements, and they were not suspended. This one fellow who was actually Jewish, and we can discuss him as well, he's the one who actually, quote, ratted on me. He was a follower of mine on Twitter, and he's a good friend of Nigel Farage's. He tweeted that after the election, before the election, there was some there was some belief that in Birmingham in England, where there's a lot of Muslim people, that there would be some kind of election fraud. And he stated for the record that, go figure, it was Birmingham with all those people present. So he was stating that basically it was Muslims who would be committing electoral fraud. And, you know, he got away with that. And there was not even an issue. He wasn't even reprimanded for that. There were other people who called people who were Muslim barbaric, and they were told that it was wrong to say so, but they were not suspended for that.
Right.
All I said was that this woman had interests that were not of a British nature, and her interests were in the European Union and her Zionist mates in Israel. I didn't mention her being Jewish. I didn't make any insulting comments, but that was enough to suspend me.
Right.
So that tells me you can make comments about Muslims, but you can't make comments about Jews.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a lot of people that have throughout Europe raised concerns that there seem to be many parties, and specifically then those who are gaining popularity in the European Union, all over, or in all of Europe, that kind of it doesn't seem to be about the national politics anymore. It seems that the main concern is Middle Eastern politics. It's the same old, you know, pro-Israeli versus pro-Islam, or I guess anti-Israeli versus anti-Islam. And do you think that that's kind of like a false dichotomy, ultimately, that British politics, you know, shouldn't primarily be involved in that question?
Well, yeah, one has to ask, you know, the quote, far-right groups in Britain, where the money's coming from. The English Defence League, the EDL, receives all of its funding from the United States, from Zionist think tanks. There's a fellow named, I think it's Frank Gaffney, who actually started the English Defence League, which is primarily focused on, you know, Islam in the United Kingdom. And although on the surface I agree Islam is a major problem in the United Kingdom, as it is in Sweden, probably even a bigger problem in Sweden than it is in the UK. But certainly we should not be focusing on this. I mean, it's a smoke screen for one, and it's a symptom of a bigger problem. And the problem is not Islam. The problem is the people who are bringing these people into the country.
Right.
And the people who run the show are not Muslim. You know, Muslims do not run the British government. They do not run our media. They do not run our newspapers. They do not represent the immigrants in courts. They're not the lawyers. They're not the media tycoons. They're not the people who program the television. They have no control whatsoever over British politics. So we have to ask the question, why are these people coming to the country? How are they getting to the country? Who is bringing them into the country? In your country, there's a woman by the name of Barbara Spector, I'm sure you know quite well.
Yeah.
She's not Muslim.
No, that's correct.
And she has a very specific ideology that she promotes. And, you know, that has nothing to do with Islam, but her politics brings Islamism into Sweden. But her politics is based in Israel and the United States.
Exactly. And, it's quite interesting. I've always wondered about what the real motives behind this is, because obviously, like, if you look at what's happening, I mean, if it's true what Barbara Spector says, and I don't think, folks, we need to play it again. We have in a couple of shows, and if you don't know, simply Google Barbara Spector and you'll find the YouTube clip and listen to it, and you'll hear what she says. But, for example, in our third largest city, Malmö, right now, we have a large Muslim population. But what's interesting there is that also then, you know, so-called anti-Semitism is on the rise in Malmö as well. And this is not from native Swedish population, but it's from the Muslim population, you know. So I was wondering what is the objective? How does it, because it doesn't make sense to me to a certain extent. Does it make sense to you, Jack, of what's happening?
It does. I think that the anti-Semitism is blowback. And I think that, unfortunately, you know, a lot of these people did not recognize that there would be blowback because of the tensions in the Middle East and because of the wars that have transpired since all the mass immigration and also brought the immigrants in. But I think that with cultural Marxism and the people that promote this ideology, destabilizing the indigenous culture is crucial to creating an environment where Zionists and Jews can do well in that country. So you need a country that has a fragile culture to enable Jews to do really well. It's an evolutionary strategy, as Dr. Kevin MacDonald would say, and I think that makes sense. So you weaken the host nation, and then, I mean, look at the United States. I mean, it's an intentional weakening of the host nation where there is not one cultural identity anymore. It's multicultural identity. Therefore, individual factions can thrive in this environment. And the number one way to do that is to bring in immigration. I mean, that's the most important way. It's the easiest way to do so. You bring in people with an entirely different culture.
Now, let me ask you about something else, because I've heard a couple of other explanations. I want to get your take on that. So, sure. Some people have the same concerns, basically, what you've mentioned about UKIP, but for the Sweden Democrats in Sweden, and that they have kind of the same stance. You've seen some of the people that are involved. They have, you know, Israeli and Swedish flags, and there's people who are, you know, kind of directly lobby groups that are between Jewish interest groups and the Sweden Democrats, etc. But some people have said, we'll get your take on this, that, well, one of the reasons for this is primarily to the support for Israel comes as a kind of a knee-jerk reaction to disassociate themselves with anything that might be perceived as Nazi, right? Because this is the image that the rest of the media is portraying on them, and they're saying, oh my God, they're Nazis practically, and so their response politically from a strategical point of view has been, no, actually, we're pro-Israeli. But I don't know, does that hold water in your view?
Well, I think that might be the case. Organically, people might say to themselves as well, I don't want to be seen as a Nazi, therefore I might as well support the enemy of my enemy, which would be the Jews in this case. A lot of, you know, today's right-wing people see Islam as the enemy in their country, because obviously they live on, you know, on the ground, you're on a daily basis in the inner city, you're dealing with Islamic people, not really Jewish people. Certainly, it's a knee-jerk reaction to that. Certainly, but one has to ask themselves, where's the money coming from? Is it coming from Zionist organizations in the United States that are promoting wars in the Middle East to benefit Israel and the United States, or is it coming from organizations that are genuinely concerned with Islam and Great Britain? The money's not coming from Christian organizations in Britain who are concerned about Islamic takeover. It's coming from organizations in the United States that are more concerned about wars in Syria and Libya and Iran. So I really believe that although people on the ground might be doing what you're saying by gravitating towards Israel as a reaction to, I don't want to be seen as a Nazi, but certainly the people that are calling the shots, you know, funneling the money into the United Kingdom and into Sweden, certainly are counting on this reaction as well. Right. I think that their end game is certainly not to get rid of Islam from Europe. It's really to create an anti-Islamic Islamophobia, basically. So there's a hatred of Islam to such an extent where we want to bomb these countries. I mean, the average American who says he loves the United States, he wants to bomb every country in the Middle East. I mean, I speak to a lot of American patriots in my travels, and they all seem to want to engage in wars in the Middle East. They have no understanding of Middle Eastern politics. They do not understand, you know, they don't understand that American geopolitical strategy does not benefit from being tied to Israel. You know, obviously it's much smarter to be distance yourself from Israel if you want to keep the price of oil down and if you want to have stability. But they still want to engage in these conflicts because the people that fund their organizations in the Tea Party, in the churches in the United States, just like in the EDL in the United Kingdom, Britain First, and now, sadly, UKIP, money's coming from Zionist organizations. Certainly, the EDL and the Britain First and these, quote, anti-Islamic organizations are getting all of their money from Jewish groups. UKIP, no, certainly not. It comes from a variety of different places, but I think a lot of it's now coming from these same places as well. And like I said, I'm not sure if it's come since, you know, the UKIP has gained popularity or it's been all along. I don't know. I'm doing a lot of research on it. I'm not sure myself.
Well, it's an interesting take. I mean, I've discussed that with others, you know, too, on the program that, you know, I don't think we have to get too conspiratorial. We're just talking about things that, you know, potential political strategies here, that the long-term effect of mass immigration and specifically then because we have so many Muslims coming into Europe is to kind of build up sentiments for a way for that, like the Europeans feel that it's their conflict and responsibility to deal or clean up the situation in the Middle East or something like that. It's very interesting. I mean, that because people are very one-dimensional to a certain extent on this question in a way that they tend only to react what they see in front of their eyes. And obviously at the same time, I have to agree because there is a problem for people who are living in a transitional neighborhood. There might be religious problems between people and conflicts and hardship on a more cultural level and people who don't understand each other, what have you. So I understand that. But at the same time, if there's something more behind it, we definitely should know about that, that if this is an intended triggered response, if you see what I'm saying.
It is. I think it is an intended triggered response. I think it's a great way to put it. It might be a knee-jerk reaction on the ground, but certainly it's an intentional triggered response from the people at the top. They recognize. I mean, I saw a speech a couple of years ago from former BNP MEP. I think he was discussing this, and he pointed to the fact that the majority of the money in these far-right groups in Great Britain and France come from Zionist organizations. So why would Zionist organizations be promoting far-right groups in Europe? I mean, is it because they want to make sure that they don't turn on the Jews, or is it because they want to make sure they focus their attention on the Muslims? I think it's because they want to focus their attention on the Muslims, and so that our countries will support the wars in the Middle East.
Yeah, it's an interesting suggestion and idea, of course, that I think is very very important to discuss and become more aware about. What more can you say that, let's say, for those who doubt this, who don't think you're telling the truth about this, is something more you can say about the funding and the connections and the various organizations over in the U.S. that are supporting those in Europe? What more can you say about that?
I mean, I would suggest Googling English Defense League, Zionism, Frank Gaffney. And I think it was a speech by former British National Party MEP Nick Griffin regarding where the money comes from for the EDL, which would be the number one grassroots right-wing anti-Islamic organization in Britain. The money is all coming from these organizations. The money is not coming from people on the street of streets of Great Britain. It's coming from the United States. I mean, he did a great video on the YouTube. I think you can find it at some, I think it was at some nationalist convention in Europe about 4 or 5 years ago. He pointed where the money was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite a remarkable journey. The money literally originates in Washington, D.C., and it ends up on buses full of football hooligans in Lincolnshire.
Right.
I mean, it's right. Quite remarkable. Just follow the money trail. I mean, I think that's what really we need to do in all these instances is follow the trail of money.
Mm-hmm. Well, interesting. Now, let's talk about UKIP directly then a little bit more and what you've found or what you think. You can clarify that for us and how this kind of funding and whatnot relates to the UKIP directly, that they have kind of come in there to a certain extent and try to fill the role of being the party that receives the negative sentiments against immigration and say, yes, we're going to do that. Because, I mean, that's true on one hand, but at the same time, on the other, as you said, they've been trying, as far as I can see, to kind of, well, you know, kind of abide by political correctness, and they're trying to become more, popular and tolerable, I guess, to certain people. But where do they stand here? Where are they going to turn next to be able to gain then politically if that's what they want to do?
Well, I mean, quite interesting. This last week, the week earlier, UKIP has made a concerted effort to embrace the gay and lesbian community, which is quite interesting because the gay it was quite funny. Nigel Farage wanted to march in the London Gay Pride Parade. And I don't know why he would want to do such a thing, because very few gay people support UKIP, but he wanted to march in it. And there's a lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender UKIP friends organization, which is quite popular. And even in my constituency, it was quite remarkable. There was a fellow named David Massam. He's a little council candidate. But to my hustings, which is a debate where I basically discuss my platform with the entire party, and it was open to the public, he brought the local university gay liberation officer to meet with me privately. I mean, here I am. I'm running for UKIP. And my main issue is, bringing back conservative politics, proper conservative politics, but also, touches, old Labour at the same time. But I'm not interested in, homosexual agenda in any way, shape, or form. I'm not interested in even discussing it. It's not something that really interests me. But for him to bring this gay liberation officer to meet me privately and then try to bring me to a university to debate this issue about gay and lesbian politics, obviously support it, was quite shocking. So I was taken aback, but why this gentleman was at my speech, why he wanted to meet me privately, why one of my council candidates brought him, and then why he would involve me in a debate over these issues where the number one topic would have been gay issues in Britain. I mean,
well, it's so strange because it's these, frankly, issues that are very much on the fringes of things that are pertaining to politics that are taking the center stage. It's really the sign of the confused times that we're in. We're trying to, where people are trying to, you know, straight out just being liked by those who already oppose you and hate you, right? And that's kind of the... And so they spend an incredible amount of effort and time on those kinds of things without just saying, you know, listen, this is my politics, this is what I'm, you know, standing for, this is what I think we should do to make Britain a better place. How about that? You know, it's like that time of being simple and clear like that, it seems to be over at the moment.
Yeah, I think most people have lost their minds, unfortunately. I mean, the fact that, you know, when you go to a school and you speak to students, that they only want to speak about issues that affect 0.1% of the population.
Right.
And people say to me, well, what about, you know, gay adoption? I said, we're talking about an issue that affects so few people. I don't want to discuss that. I don't have an opinion on it. I do, but you know, when you're dealing with 17-year-old students who've been indoctrinated from birth, I mean, if I'm going to tell them that I'm against it, that's the end of the day for me. So for me, it's easy to say, look, this is not something that is going to impact our nation in a major way. But that's all they want to speak about. And then when you say to them, look, this is like you use the word fringe. That's a word I would use as well. They jump on that, say, well, you're saying these are fringe elements now. And they think you're actually attacking them. They really believe that these issues are the most important issues the country faces.
Right.
We have, you know, we have unemployment. We have fathers who can't see their children. We have the average child doesn't see their father anymore. We have single mothers everywhere. We have, you know, depression, suicide, stabbings.
And the demographic makeup of Britain is being changed in a way that it never has before, right?
We have, you know, every year several hundred thousand migrants from Africa, the Middle East, Asia, Eastern Europe flooding our shores, demanding we change to adhere to their customs, their policies, to suit their needs. And you want to speak to me about one gay family in a town of 25,000 people, and their right to say that they're no longer they're civil partners, they're actually married. I'm sorry, that's not an issue for me.
Yeah,
I'm against it, but I don't want to speak about that. And I found that I was being driven to speak about that on almost a daily basis, that it would come up in every conversation I would have, and I would not bring it up. And it got to the point where even UKIP was kowtowing to this issue. And I'm not sure, is it because they felt they had to, or it was because this was always an issue from the get-go. I think it's probably a combination. I mean, for example, there's the Lesbian and Gay Association or the Lesbian Gay Friends of UKIP. They're quite popular. I mean, they followed me on YouTube. I'm sorry, on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And I was quite shocked they would follow me. I mean, my politics is quite clear. And I recognize a lot of people were following me who were attacking me in tweets. And I recognize that during the end stages of my campaign, that I was being followed by lots of Jewish UKIP members, lots of Muslim UKIP members, Lesbian and Gay Association members, and they were basically probably reporting me to head office. And when I was suspended, I was actually reported by this fellow named Schnur Udzi. I referred to him earlier. He was the fellow that that I mentioned had stated that in Birmingham there would be electoral fraud because of the fact there were lots of Muslim voters. He also is famous for not shaking the hands of women at events because
mm-hmm.
he's an extreme Orthodox.
Yeah.
And he's also quite remarkably, and this is something that, you know, you'd only know on the inside, and I have no problem saying this, in all the chat rooms, the private chat rooms within UKIP, he is extremely close mates with Nigel Farage. We at the election have the ability to bring 10 people to our count. A count is where they literally count the votes in front of us, and we bring our mates to it. We bring people who we believe will monitor it for us. It's just a good time. You bring your good friends. For me to find 10 people to come overnight to a count takes some effort. Not everybody wants to go to these events. But for Nigel Farage to find 10 people, he could find 10,000 people to go to his count, obviously. He chose this Schnur Udzi to go to his count.
Hmm, interesting.
And, you know, this is quite remarkable because, like I said, only 10 people get to go to the count. And, you know, he chose him. And Schnur Udzi was the one who reported me. And when I recognized that he was the one who reported me, he had written articles for Jewish newspapers about me. I tweeted him and said, well, now I know why I was just suspended. He responded, I feel sorry for you, you anti-Semitic so-and-so. And, you know, that's really, this is who was obviously calling the shots. So I'm quite sure that UKIP has had several important meetings with other Jewish organizations in the last few months where Stephen Wolf, who's UKIP's immigration spokesperson, he's a quarter Jewish, a quarter black. He's in charge of UKIP's immigration policy. He's spoken at several Zionist functions. he's been on the record as saying that boycotting Israel is unethical and it's hateful. So these people are quite clear that they are very supportive of Israel. And so if anybody is critical of Israel, they have become persona non grata, unfortunately, like myself.
Like you did. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, so basically you're a person that isn't under the same control as the others. And, you know, these kinds of things have been happening in Sweden as well. Specifically, I mentioned the Sweden Democrats earlier, but the youth section of this party, specifically two gentlemen, that were outed recently because it was not a similar thing, but it was basically the feeling, I think, from the top of the party that they don't have these people under control, that were young guys, they were popular, they were like up and coming guys, and one day they might be able to take over the party even because this is the way the current top in the party actually did it. They're fearing that the same thing will happen to them, so they're preemptively trying to just get them out of the way, kind of thing. But I mean, is there a chance, do you think, that UKIP ever actually will get to power in Britain? And is this the way that they're trying to do it? They're trying to purge out the unwanted kind of elements that they don't have under control, if you will, so that they will be kind of accepted into the inner halls of politics in Britain. I don't know. What do you think?
I think there's some element of truth in it. Certainly, there are people within the party that are delusional, who believe that UKIP will win a general election. UKIP will not win a general election. The average person at the convention I spoke with believed UKIP would win 20 to 30 seats. UKIP would win one seat. Next time, I would doubt they'll even win one seat, because if we have the referendum and it's successful, then UKIP is obsolete. If we don't have the referendum, if we have the referendum and it's unsuccessful, then UKIP is obsolete. So at the end of the day, I can't see UKIP doesn't really have too many policies outside of immigration. And even on immigration, it's flawed. I mean, Nigel Farage has been quite clear. He wants to keep the doors open. Just he wants to have the Commonwealth flood the United Kingdom and not the European Union. It's good for business. Therefore, it's good for Nigel Farage. So I think that once people recognize that UKIP is a one-trick pony, and that horse is obviously no longer in the race, because European Union is a non-issue, I don't see how UKIP will it be electable in any way, shape, or form. And because if UKIP is not against mass immigration, which they're not, they're only against the European Union, and we vote to stay in or leave the European Union, then what's the point of voting for UKIP? I mean,
right.
They still want to keep the floodgates open. They don't want to stop immigration. They had an opportunity, and this is interesting, this is probably maybe in February or March, they had a chance to, on a television program in Britain, to say they would impose a quota. And I was waiting for this moment. They said, would you actually have a quota? And Stephen Wolfe responded, we will not have a quota. And this was the moment I was waiting for, that they would say they would have a quota. I mean, no one said a moratorium. A quota is quite simple. You can give a number. You can give 100,000 as a quota. You can give 50,000, even 150,000. No quota. That's because Nigel Farage has said in the European Parliament that he wanted 250,000 people a year coming to Britain to help with, increase the labor force. So, I mean, why would he go back on that? He's just against the European Union. He's not against mass immigration.
Now, do you think they're just kind of saying this again to be able to end up in a position where they can have more influence and power? And I'm not saying that just because I think they are really good guys or whatnot. It's just kind of, I don't know, kind of to a certain extent. But is any of this political strategy, do you think, so that later on they're like begin to reform if they get more power, maybe? I don't know.
No, that makes sense. I think in some ways it is. I mean, I had the chat with Andrew Bronze, the MEP. He and I had a great lunch and we discussed all these topics, and he was quite adamant that UKIP, it's controlled opposition, and their objective is just to basically take votes away from true nationalist parties and then promote the same business as usual politics by using the European Union as a kind of scapegoat for British problems, which is, again, it makes sense what he's saying. Again, is this something that UKIP was doing all along? Or, as you're saying, have done this because they believe it's the only way for them to get into power? I don't know. I'm not sure myself. I do know that UKIP is not right for Britain because they're promoting mass immigration. But why they're doing so, I don't know. I can tell you, though, the average person who supports UKIP is very against mass immigration. I mean, the average parliamentary candidate at UKIP is great. I mean, I could tell you that they're all horrible, but no, I would say out of the several hundred parliamentary candidates I met for UKIP, I can't even think of one, maybe one, I didn't like, to be honest with you. They were all really good people. They were all quite aware of what was going on. They believed that UKIP was the way forward because it was the only party that was electable. But they were genuine. Yeah. They were quite genuine. Unfortunately, the people at the top are not genuine. The people who run UKIP are dreadful. The people who work their rear ends off to bring UKIP to power are wonderful. I mean, the average volunteer for UKIP is a really, you know, red-blooded Englishman who cares about the country, who genuinely wants the country to return to the way it was. So I would never denigrate the people who support UKIP. I think UKIP supporters are probably the best people in Britain, to be honest with you. Unfortunately, the party is run by people who don't really care about the country.
Yeah. Was it, I can't remember how long Farage has been part of it, maybe since the beginning, but is there the people around him, do you think, that has, you know, co-opted the issues and turned things around, or has it been like this from the start?
Well, I was told by people in the party that anytime anybody comes to the party who does a good job and who wants to change things around, that they get booted out by Farage and company. So they had some fellow came in who wanted to revamp their entire strategy, and he did a great job, but they kicked him out because he was too on the ball. And I think they're scared of, I mean, you look at the type of people they surround Farage with. I mean, Paul Nuttall is a perfect example. I mean, how could he be the deputy leader of a political party? He's undereducated. I mean, the joke is in the European Union that the majority of the people couldn't understand his accent. It's so kind of colloquial Liverpool accent. He's uneducated. He's uncouth. And he is the deputy of the party. But there are plenty of people in UKIP who are vastly more intelligent than he is, but why are they not the deputy leader? Well, because Nigel Farage wants someone with him who will do as he says. The people that are intelligent, who could do a good job within the party, aren't promoted because obviously they're a threat to the people who run the party.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's just talk a little bit about if there are any options in the UK right now. Are there any party that in the UK they're there to actually look after the interest of the British people, not just the British citizens, but actually the British people?
I mean, there are lots of nationalist parties. I'm working with the BNP right now. I'm trying to help them.
Can they be revived, do you think?
That's a great question. See, that's the question that everyone asks me on the ground. I hope so. You know, I wouldn't have gotten involved if I felt that there was no way they could revive themselves. You know, I'm going to give it my best. The people who support the BNP are the same type of people who support UKIP. So on the ground, the average UKIP supporter and the average BNP supporter are very similar. So you have the same sort of people. So one needs, if the BNP are going to recover, they're going to have to find a way to bring UKIP people back to the BNP. They're going to need to change some things. I think the strategy was incorrect, and hopefully I can do so. I'm going to be a media spokesperson for them moving forward. I'll do my best. That's all I can do. Are they electable? We will see. I mean, UKIP only won one seat with 4 million votes, so it's a tough one. All we can do is our best, really. I mean, like I said, I mean, the average, I believe that the British people need a good nationalist party to represent them. UKIP is full of wonderful people, but the leaders are poor. And I hopefully, you know, with the BNP, hopefully that we can do some things right.
Isn't that true of most nations right now? We don't have any good leaders, you know. Genuine people that are there to look after the interests of the people. It just seems so difficult, and the options that you do get in Europe right now, although I'm positive over the sign of where things are going, they're recognizing that these are very, very problematic areas. We can't just continue as we're doing right now because we will become minorities in our own countries, our cultures and languages, and everything is changing with mass immigration in the way it is. But it's about getting people in place who can direct that, you know, because if you look at Holland, you have, you know, Geert Wilders, he seems kind of be on that same page. I'm not sure about Front National in France, Le Pen, you know, but there are questions there, right?
There are big questions with the Front National in France. I think that Le Pen's father had the idea right. I think he was on the ball. I'm not so sure about the daughter, to be honest with you. If you recognize the sort of people that she has appointed as her ministers in her cabinet, that there's at least five or six. Again, I'm not going to discuss, you know, whether I'm in favor or against homosexual issues or whatnot, but she has several gay people who she's appointed. There are also quite a few Jews in her cabinet, so I think that she's going the same direction as UKIP, to be honest with you. And I'm afraid that they're going to be a one-trick pony. But like you said earlier, Islam is a huge issue in a lot of countries. So, the enemy of your enemy, I suppose, right? I mean, I don't know whether they're being funded by some unsavory characters in Washington or Tel Aviv, but certainly, you know, in France, there's a major issue with Islam, so, you know, it might help their cause. So, again, it's a really tough call. A lot of people who are hardcore, quote, nationalists still say, you know, taking 1 cent from Jewish organizations is wrong. But I suppose if you're in Malmö, as you mentioned earlier, I've been there before, you know, to fix that city, you would take money from anywhere, wouldn't you?
Well, exactly. And my point as well is that, and it's, I tread into this area very, very lightly because I don't have any answers on this. I might have opinions, personal ones, but my point is you have to begin somewhere and you can't expect everyone to be on page and understand political strategy and things that goes on, you know, behind the curtains, if you will, and agendas that goes on that we can't see, or in some cases we can maybe, you know, we can prove them in financial trails or whatnot, but, you know, this might sound like conspiracy theories to some of the other people out there anyway, so they won't look there. So where do we turn to gain a momentum that is, to a certain extent, kind of populists, to get people that are truly want to change the direction of European countries to go in that way, you know? So it's a very tricky and delicate question, isn't it?
It is delicate. It's a very complicated question. So it's very easy to say that the moment that Jewish money enters a political party, the party is then owned. But it's also, like you said, at the same time, you have to get donations. I mean, when people told me originally that, you know, the Daily Express gave you money to UKIP, spelt the end of UKIP, even though I was in tune with this argument at that point, at that stage, £1.3 million to help you get into power, do you not take it?
Right, yeah.
I think you do take it.
Yeah.
This is the problem. But then are you in their pockets? This is very difficult.
Yeah, well,
it's a very difficult question.
Is there a contract? Is there something, or is this, I mean, on what premise are these money given and taken? You know what I mean?
Yeah, so we don't know these things. We've not been in the inner circle. We've not been in the meetings. I might know the MEPs and Nigel Farage, but I was not in that individual meeting between him and Richard Desmond where the money exchanged hands. What was said, I don't know.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Well,
I have no idea. I have no idea. Was the first sentence, you will support our agenda? Or was the first sentence, well, we think you're the best person to run the country, so we support you.
Yeah, exactly.
Here's some money.
Honestly, like, hey, listen, we might not be on every agree on all points, but we're seeing that this is a problem too in Britain, and we're concerned. We generally want to help you. You know, if that is the case, is this making things even worse by creating, you know, these kinds of divisions? I mean, I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there. I'm not saying that that's the case at all, but I'm just saying, if we're not part on the inside of these meetings, we simply won't know. We're outsiders to this, you know.
You're right. We won't know, and it's very complicated. It's very complicated. So, like, I'm, you know, I try to be objective. So, although it'd be easy for me to say on the record that, you know, UKIP is bought and paid for, at the same time, you know, you take the money. I think at the end of the day, you do take the money. I don't think you shaft your candidates. I think that you do the right thing, and you then meet with your candidates who've crossed the line, and you say, look, you've said something that has caused us a problem because of who now supports us. So you cannot do that. We recognize your right to free speech, and we support that. But right now, we have to be caught. But that's not what they did. So that's why I feel as though they crossed the line, and they violated our agreement. I spent a lot of money. I was supporting their party. They should not have thrown me under a bus without at least having a conversation. So that's why I think that there's some truth to the idea that they all bought and paid for. But at the same time, you take the money still. So it's a complicated issue. I really don't know what the answer is, to be honest with you.
Let me mention this as well. I mean, it's obviously it's easy to be suspicious when we have you know, people like Barbara Spector and things like this, and there's many others as well. That are using this kind of language and talking about it in this way, that this is in some way kind of an ethnic group interest to try to make sure that Europeans can't have ethnic interest, etc. So you have that on one hand, but on the other, one way out of this situation would potentially be there must be enough political will and direction to muster and rally the British people in this case. That's what we're talking about, but this would be true in any European country, of getting these people so involved that they are the ones who are donating some of their money and more of them as well that see what is going on, and that ultimately this become a movement of the people who are seeing that this is something that's wrong. If that was the case, problem solved to a certain extent, right?
I agree with you 100%. I think that we recognize that, you know, what makes the minority groups so successful is that they stand by each other in the communities. They donate. They spend their money. They fundraise. They campaign. They give one another jobs. But unfortunately, the British people don't do that. They don't donate to the same extent. I mean, why does Richard Desmond give £1.3 million, but Richard Branson has not given £1.3 million to UKIP?
Right.
I mean, this is the question. Why is the Jewish community, why do they have so much solidarity, and why does the British community not have that solidarity?
And when they do, they're demonized for it as well, of course, right?
Certainly. Oh, certainly, certainly. So, you know, I think that's the case. If you look at the far left, they have no shortage of money. But, you know, on the right, it's almost impossible to get a donation from anybody. I mean, people don't want to donate, unfortunately. I think it will be our undoing, I would say, that we don't stand together. We fight with each other. We don't support each other. We pick holes. I mean, I've had some issues even where people have criticized the fact that I have a grandparent who's not ethnically English. I've been criticized for that.
Who cares?
Yeah, but for them that's a big issue. Somehow I'm tainted because of that. And you know, I think I've done a great service for the nationalist movement in Britain. But then you still have some people who are so diehard puritanical that they can't see past the fact that I have a non-English grandparent. So I think that we have so much dividing us on the right. The left seem to embrace everybody, and I think they are successful because of that.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. And these points of bickering, again, ultimately, it's like it can't be defined by, and it never has been for me, the hatred of anybody else or someone else. It's about the love of my country. You know, in my case, it's Sweden, and I want to do what's good for Sweden to preserve our culture, to preserve our tradition of who we are. And I think with current levels of immigration, that is absolutely threatened, and that's something that's going to be disastrous in 3-4 generations from now. And even people I think who today might be against me and think I'm a bigot for saying that, they're going to see that by the time they're old if we're not going to do anything about this. And I don't want us to end up in a situation where it's too late at that point. I want people truly to understand what is happening and have them awaken that part of themselves where they realize what kind of world it will be if they're not going to be around as a group. I don't know. What do you think, Jack?
I agree 100%. You know, when I travel to Sweden, I have a lot of friends in Örnsköldsvik speak in northern Sweden. I don't look Swedish in any way, shape, or form. But the beauty of me being in Sweden is that I was in Sweden, Swedish people, the Swedish culture, the language. I embraced it when I was there for well over a year. I can't imagine wanting to change the people of that place. I mean, that was the reason I came to Sweden, was to experience that culture and those people. And it hurts me that recently my mum went to visit Sweden, because we now have some property up there. We did some business up there a few years ago, and she told me that they're importing asylum seekers into this small area, this rural area of northern Sweden. And you know, I felt quite choked up on the phone when I heard that, not because I hate the asylum seekers, but because, you know, the beauty of this area of northern Sweden is that it is so Swedish. And, you know, when I go there, I want to experience midsummer. I want to eat spoiled fish. I want to eat the local delicacies. I don't want it to change. I don't want the bus to be full of migrants. I'm not against the migrants. I'm not against them as people, but I want to see Sweden remain Swedish. And I think that's not a racist thing, because I myself am not Swedish. When I go to Sweden, I don't look Swedish. I look different from them. But certainly, you know, I don't feel – no one has ever mistreated me in Sweden. They're all very welcoming and very caring and kind people. And they are always surprised when I tell them that I'm against immigration, because they'll always say to me, well, we like the, you know, the multiculturals. And I'll say, well, look, I mean, I'm telling you, your country is great because it's Swedish. We need to keep it Swedish.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean we should not have, you know, Indian doctors or some people coming in to do skilled jobs. Mass immigration will destroy the country.
Exactly.
And it will forever change the complexion of the nation, will dilute the culture, it will ruin everything that the country has. And I think that, you know, it takes sometimes an immigrant to see that. But unfortunately, indigenous people don't want to see it. I think in a lot of cases, in Britain and in Sweden, I believe that people are quite modest. and they don't want to believe that, you know, that there's anything that's truly wonderful to preserve, but there is, and I think we need to fight for that, what is worth preserving.
Absolutely. I mean, we're way too nice and too naive, for one, yeah. And we're also very collectivist, of course, which makes us prone to care very much about the social group and what they think about us and whatnot. And I think that this has been aided along now very much so with the media, for example, so that people who step out of bounds, who are not on the page on the singing along in the cultural Marxist song sheet, they get immediately punished in the media and people disassociate themselves from them. They lose, you know, in some cases, family members and friends over these kinds of things, you know, and that's what needs to, I mean, how do we, I'm not expecting you to have the answer to all these questions, but I just want to get your take on it. How do we change that, do you think, that type of climate and the environment of, well, it is fear at this point, I guess.
I think we have to stop punishing people for having an opinion. And I think that we need to, I think that, you know, the media has made us, and the way our schools are run, indoctrinating children to believe in that any sort of opinion that's, you know, quote, right-leaning is somehow an abusive opinion, it's an opinion filled with hatred. I don't think that, and another problem is a lot of people who embrace right-wing ideology are angry, and when you're angry, you express hatred. So I think we need to do what you're doing, and having this conversation with you, I can see that you come from a position of compassion and caring. You care about Sweden. You don't hate anybody else. I think that's the first step, is to say, look, we're not doing this because we hate anybody. We're doing this because we love our country. And that if an immigrant is here and he loves this country and he wants this country to be better, we should, you know, we should obviously close the door on immigration. We should close the floodgates immediately. So I'm not saying that we should have more immigrants coming in, but we should convince people who are here already to embrace our country, and we should make them realize that they have come here because our countries are great, that they should embrace us. And I think that we need to start being prouder of these things, and we need to start being openly proud of these things. Parades, songs, not racism, not hatred, but pride. And I think that's very important. I think that's one thing Britain does well, and that's why we are allowed to have an opinion that Britain is great, is that we do great parades, we sing great songs, we wave flags, we have chants. You know, and unfortunately in Sweden, I noticed a lot of the gentlemen that I met were almost scared to be proud. And I thought that was quite sad. I had a friend, actually, I'll mention him, in Sweden, named Eric, and he was half Polish and half Swedish. And he was the most pro-Swedish, conservative, traditional person I met in the region. all of his mates were so far to the left that they were almost petrified of his position. That he was disliked by the local police, even. The police didn't like him because they saw him as right-wing.
Oh, my God. Well, the thing is with that, though...
He was too pro-Swedish.
Exactly. That's just it. But the thing with that, though, is that I know another older Swedish gentleman who's been interested in politics for a long time, and he's always actually been more on the left of things, and I think he mentioned something which was very worth... He's old now, so he's been around for a while, but he mentioned something that was very well said, and it was basically that the political spectrum, the dialogue, the Overton window, whatever you want to call it, has been moved so much to the left in recent years that he, who held the position now, sure, he's anti-immigration, but still on all the other issues, he's remained very much like a traditional Swedish social democrat, like they were in the 60s and even 50s. But it's moved so much to the left. Although he's remained the same in his views, he's now considered to be extreme right wing, and that's what's so interesting in this situation, that there's no recognition that they can slab these extreme labels on us all day, all how much they want. But this is a recent invention; it wasn't always so, and they've managed to push the Overton window so much to the left, right?
And I agree 100%. My granddad was a Labour supporter, but you know he could no longer support the Labour Party in the 1980s and 90s because they had not moved to the left. They'd moved to a strange position on the left where they would formally embrace the working man, the culture of the country, trying to, you know, obviously fight for the rights of the people. They now were fighting for the rights of certain people. And these certain people were the ones doing the damage in the country, namely the immigrants and the fringe groups we discussed earlier. So although my granddad was all for the rights of the workers, the rights of the working man, the rights of the disenfranchised, he wasn't for the rights of the people who had come to the country and damaged the country. And so I think that they've moved to the left, but they've also moved to a strange spot on the left that does not – one has to ask, well, who votes for these parties now? In Great Britain, you know, it's the immigrants, the minorities, it's women – So obviously they embrace women's issues, and women's issues unfortunately hurt men. I mean, because they're not really women's issues. They're more anti-family women's issues. So it's, you know, career first, divorce, no responsibility whatsoever for your actions. And I think that the left have embraced these groups because obviously they recognize that's how they stay in power. So they no longer represent the working man. So I think your friend, I'm sure as well, was probably for the working man and for the family, whereas the left now doesn't care about the family or the working man. He cares about some bizarre fringe groups that used to be ridiculous, but today they're, unfortunately, they are the left champion fringe groups, basically. And they have been doing so for about 15, 20 years now.
Yeah, at least. It's, Let me ask you a couple of things here as a kind of a way of beginning to round up a little bit, I guess, and what your recommendations are in terms of what you think can be done to turn things around and how to what direction do we move, and are you positive? Are you hopeful that Europe will remain European in the future, or what will happen, do you think?
Unfortunately, I don't think Western Europe will remain Western European, and I hate saying it because it hurts me to say that. I love Western European culture. I love our individual cultures even more. I love Swedish culture, English culture, Italian culture. I think they need to remain intact. And the way things are going, unfortunately, unless we tell the people who are already in the country that, look, you adhere to our rules, you abide by our wishes, you follow, you eventually, you know, no one's saying, you know, you have to marry a non-ethnically indigenous person, but certainly let's give them a chance to embrace our culture. If they're already here legally, it's going to be hard to repatriate everybody who's come from another country into our countries. What we need to do is try to get them to embrace us. But unfortunately, it's very difficult when the left are telling the Muslim he needs to stay separate. And everyone stays separate, and no one has any interest whatsoever of embracing indigenous culture. So I think I think that the way forward is more culturalism than anything. We need to be very fiercely, strongly proud, fiercely proud of our cultures. And in order to stomp out multiculturalism, we need to make sure our culture remains dominant. It's going to be really difficult to avoid. Obviously, our cultures are already now multiracial. I think we recognize that. So we need to obviously close the borders at this point. But we need to make sure the people in the country are allowed to embrace our cultures. I mean, I've met some people who are, in fact, Hindus, who are Eastern Europeans, who said, we love your country. It's your left that are the problem. Even I had a conversation with the London organizer for the BNP, Stephen Squire, just the other day. And I asked him, he said he goes on events in Muslim areas. And I said, what's the reaction from the Muslims? You must have a lot of hatred. He said, believe it or not, we have bigger problems with the whites. I said, what do you mean by that? He said, well, the white leftist is our problem.
Yeah. Right.
He said, the Muslim always says to me, we understand why you're marching for the British National Party, because you're British.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the white leftist who throws the beer bottles, who throws the eggs, who throws paint bombs, who calls the police, who threatens to close down the event. It's not the Muslims. So when you go to an event, whether it's even an EDL event, which is we already discussed it, a Zionist-run anti-Muslim event, the protesters are not even Muslim. They're typically whites. I mean, if the enemy is in the population, how can you succeed? Think about that. It's quite difficult. I think that we need to focus our energy on the people who are really subverting our countries, and whether that be the left or the people we discussed earlier, the Zionists or whatever, or even just white English people who are subverting English culture through their insane ideas. I think these are the problem. I think they're the ones who are destroying the country more than the immigrants. The immigrants are being given a pass to come into the country. Who is giving them the pass? We just take the passes away and get rid of the people giving the passes out to the immigrants. Instead of worrying about the immigrants, we need to start worrying about the people who are making the decisions.
Yeah, and ourselves. We've said that on many shows, that it's not really about what everyone else is doing, ultimately, in a way. So there can be interests that are conflicting with ours and whatnot, but it's really what we do. And I think something you mentioned before is very, very important. I want to emphasize that again, that we need to, I guess, kind of, well, awaken and revive things that are already there in our cultural memory, if you will, and bring those things back. It's not that we need to invent something or, you know, nothing like that, because it's there already. We just have to bring them out. It's something that is part of our culture. Many people today even don't consider that European, you know, somehow Europeans are not native, or they don't have a native tradition. And it's like, we do. It's it's there. Everything is there. This needs to be something that is offered to people as something which is which is attractive, which is to be something to be proud of. The people can see that, you know, this is who we are. But frankly, it is something that has successfully been removed from who we are. And it's almost like that we have become, although I don't like that critique to a certain extent, but, you know, some people have actually fallen into that trap and we've become kind of dry and we don't, you know, don't look after our cultural heritage in the way that we should. But I think when we do, there is something there that is going to attract and awaken other people with it. What do you think?
No, I agree 100%. I think that, you know, enough with cultural relativism. I think we need to say we have a wonderful culture. We need to promote it. We need to embrace it. Teach it at school. I mean, the average student today thinks that Britain's industrial age and Britain's colonial age was all about exploiting people. And they only hear one side of the argument. I mean, it was a great period in British history, but people are so embarrassed of it. It's quite remarkable. And I think that we need to embrace our past and say, look at wonderful things we've done. Look at the wonderful things we brought to Africa. Yes, fine. Maybe there was some exploitation, but look at what was left behind. The Indian democracy is the largest one in the world. Well, why is it the largest democracy in the world? It was because Great Britain brought it to India. Why is the Indian Railway the largest railway system in the world?
Yep.
Because the British built the system. So why can't we be proud of these things? You know, it's funny. You go to Asia. You go to Japan. They love our culture. They think it's wonderful. They think we have the greatest culture on the planet. But yet, in our own country, we think our culture is terrible. We think that our cultures are flawed. We're evil people. We don't. You and I don't. But certainly, the average person thinks there's little to be proud of in Western culture. And that's shameful. But then again, we have to ask ourselves, who's filling our children's minds with this information? It's not the immigrants. It's, again,
the
unions of teachers, the teacher teachers,
education, media, you know, all that stuff, and it turns, you know, not only non-issues into the biggest story of the year, as you said before, and omit the important stuff and where the real problems lie, but they omit you know, positive items and things historically, and just as you said, it's just turning into one big story about, you know, slavery, exploitation, and the Holocaust, and that's about it. That's like Western Civ now, you know. It's like there's a lot more to it than that, you know, and there are a lot of things to be proud of that is within that anyway. So I think that, you know, that needs to be encouraged, that needs to be brought out, and it can be objective to a certain extent. It doesn't have to be, you know, over-the-top positive just for the sake of it. I think one of the strengths is to be able to look at the things that have been done and embrace those and say, okay, what do we do from here? I mean, let's face it. I mean, Europe was one of the first areas, together with Americas, to abandon slavery, for example. It's still practiced in some parts of the world, for example. We're not given any credit for those kinds of things, you know what I mean? And that's ridiculous, you know?
I think that's a great point. I mean, you know, Western Europe is the first to abolish slavery. And the average Western European person, even living in the United States, never even owned a slave. But yet we're told, you know, ad nauseum, that's, you know, every single person who is of white ancestry in the United States was a slave, is descended from a slave owner.
Yeah, right.
I mean, the Hollywood is, you know, they've written the book on, you know, what, you know, America's an evil country because Hollywood tells us it is.
Yeah.
And not for what it's done, but for what they've said it's done. Slavery, this, that, and the other. The Germans are evil because of the Holocaust. I mean, doesn't matter the proud history of the German people. You know, the reasons behind World War II, those are irrelevant. It's just that they only remember for certain historical events. And like you said, I think that this has been done deliberately, obviously, and it's done, unfortunately, through the media and through the schools and the education system. And maybe I can ask you a question, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I was told by a friend of mine in Sweden recently on the telephone that in schools, young children are told that they're not to refer to themselves as he and she.
Mm-hmm.
They have to refer to themselves as it. Is that the case, or is he mistaken?
It's a genderless pronoun, right? So that's, and I've actually seen some of the people bringing it in now. It's just unbelievable. It's just sickening.
So it's true. He wasn't joking there.
No. Hen, that's what they said. So we usually have, for him, we say han, and for her, we say hun. And so what they did is they just invented a new one that says hen. Okay, great. Let's do it.
Oh,
you know.
My goodness.
So, it's a war. It's a war on gender. It's a war on anything that's traditional, anything that has any kind of anchoring to nature, our human nature and our past, and that's what they're worrying on, and we need to fight back, you know.
It's funny. I mean, they're coming from a position of hatred. We're coming from a position of love. But yet we're told we're the hateful people and they're the loving people.
Exactly.
But, you know, but the hate is actually coming from the left. I mean, they hate, like you said, the tradition, the culture. Even, you know, gender roles are seen as evil nowadays. There's no such thing as gender roles. Just everything we've had, it needs to be thrown into the trash because it's evil. So obviously that's... people who are pushing this obviously don't like us much.
Exactly.
I think we need to also be very, and I've stressed this a lot with people, is that nationalism should become patriotism, hatred becomes love, and racism becomes culturalism. That's what it was. That we need to be culturalistic. I know it sounds, it's not a word, but it is going to be a word in the vernacular in the next few years. Culturalism is very important. We need to be, we need to believe our cultures are superior, and we should say that, look, you come here because we have a great culture. So we, instead of saying, you know, we are a better race of people, let's just say we have a better culture. That's why you come to our countries. And obviously, certain ethnicities build great cultures, so they're connected as well. So you, as an indigenous person, you could say, well, it's my people that built this culture, created this culture. But by saying that, say we are better than you, our culture is the best, that's why you've come here, please embrace it now. I think people need to do that. I think that that's very important, that when someone denigrates England, I always say, you know, why would you say such a thing? I mean, this is a great country. And a lot of English people always slag off England. And I always, always say, you know, quit slagging off this country. We have the left slag the country off. The immigrants slag the country off. You know, when we start slagging the country off, then we really have a problem.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's going to catch up to us sooner or later anyway. All right. Well, I think we've left the audience with a few things to chew on here, as they say. Jack, it's been great having you here. Very, very interesting. Very interesting hearing about UKIP and what happened to you and your story as well. Is there anything else that you feel that we've left out that you'd like to, I guess, for the record, set straight or anything that is important to mention before we end for this time? What do you think?
Well, yeah, there's one thing I did not mention is that I actually was on the ballots. I was... although I had UKIP next to my name, I was, for all intents and purposes, an independent. I got 6,000 votes, which was about 13%. I finished ahead of most of the MEPs in the north of England. So even though most of my constituents thought I was suspended, they still voted for me. So I still got a huge percentage of the vote. And, you know, although I lost a couple percentage points from what I would have gotten if I was not suspended, I still was able to remain on the ballot because I was nominated for the process before they suspended me. And even though I would not have been an MP for UKIP, I did better than most of the parliamentary candidates for UKIP. So I was quite happy with the results.
All right, very good. Now, do you have any, I don't know, websites or Twitter, Facebook, anything like that you'd like to give out for people who want to get in touch with you or follow you more closely?
I have a Twitter page. I think it's quite ironically still at JackSendUKIP. I have not changed that yet. They can check out the articles on the internet. Basically, if you Google my name, Jack Sen, you'll find articles on The Guardian. Well, they're all criticizing me, but I think they're quite good anyway, because I tell the truth in each of the articles. So there's an article in The Guardian, The Independent, Channel 4, which is a major news station in Great Britain. If the Occidental Observer did a good story. I was interviewed by them, as well as Prague out of South Africa, European Nights. There's quite a few websites that have covered some of my work, and hopefully there'll be some more in the future as well.
Yeah, exactly. And we have most of those links that you mentioned, so we'll make sure that those are up on the program page for this show, folks. So just click through from our site here if you want to read more of Jack's story. But thank you so much for joining us, Jack. Yeah, well, keep up the good work and keep us posted, and good luck with your political endeavors in the future. I hope you find a new party and somewhere to turn. I know you talked about BNP, but whether you remain there or find somewhere else, I wish you all the best of luck, and hopefully you can... be part in turning the situation around in Britain.
Thanks very much. I appreciate that. And I think what I want to do is just keep telling the truth, and, you know, things will work out. I'm quite sure.
And that wraps up our show for today, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening. If you want more, sign up for a membership at redicemembers.com. Your interest and support helps us to go further, do more, and grow. A special thanks to all our new and regular members. As always, thank you so much. We have more coming, folks. We're working on an explosive video on the Charleston church shooting right now. Our next show will be a bit more on the lighter side, as we have the goys from The Right Stuff, the Daily Showa, with us. Some much-needed humor. Making fun of liberals is always fun, but we'll discuss some serious issues as well, so don't miss that upcoming. We'll speak more soon, everybody. Take care, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.